the images in Gaza, this comes home, and it becomes more and more difficult to dissociate the United States from Israel. And that's really unfortunate.
Karim Makdisi, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of international politics at American University of Beirut, co-host of the Makdisi Street podcast, speaking to us from Beirut. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer issued a joint statement Monday endorsing the latest push by mediators in Qatar, Egypt, and the United States to broker a ceasefire agreement for Israel's war on Gaza. The three countries have urged Israel and Hamas to meet for negotiations Thursday, August 15th, in either Cairo or Doha to finalize a deal. However, Hamas has called on the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt to implement the ceasefire proposal put forward by President Joe Biden in May, instead of holding more rounds of negotiations and discussing new proposals for Gaza. The May 6th proposal was agreed to by Hamas at the time and rejected by Israel. In a statement Sunday, Hamas said, quote, the mediators shouldn't force this May 6 proposal on Israel instead of pursuing further rounds of negotiations or new proposals that would provide cover for the occupation's aggression and grant it more time to continue its genocide against our people, unquote. On Monday, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel was asked about the ceasefire talks.
Are the ceasefire talks that you called for August 15, are they still going to go ahead after what Hamas said last night?
So I'm aware of those comments from Hamas, and we fully expect talks to move forward as they should. All negotiators should return to the table and bring this deal to conclusion. We believe that there has been headway made, but we need to finalize this agreement, continue to close and bridge some gaps. But we believe that an agreement is possible, and that's something that we're going to continue to work between the parties.
Meanwhile, the Israeli assault of Gaza continues with 32 Palestinians killed in the last 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The spokesperson for Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigade, said Monday one Israeli hostage was killed and two other women captives seriously wounded in two separate incidents in Gaza. The United Nations Security Council is meeting today to discuss the war in Gaza in the wake of this weekend's devastating Israeli airstrike on a school and a mosque within it in Gaza City that killed over 100 Palestinians. Daniel Levy joins us, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Daniel Levy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Okay, Qatar, U.S., and Egypt calling for sit-down negotiations on Thursday, August 15th. Hamas saying they want to stick with Biden's proposal from May. Can you talk about how far apart these sides are and the significance of the chief Hamas negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh, having been assassinated in Tehran on the day that the new Iranian president was inaugurated? What that means for these talks?
Absolutely. Look, it's very hard to make the case, if you are an objective observer of this, that the Israeli party is interested in a ceasefire, in even getting its own hostages back, when it assassinates the political leader of the movement that it is in negotiations with, at a very high-profile, sensitive location and moment. And therefore, what you read day in, day out, in much of the Israeli press, Amy, what you hear from many named and unnamed Israeli security officials, not just those of us on the outside saying, okay, let me put the jigsaw puzzle together. It's quite clear, Netanyahu does not want a ceasefire deal. And therefore, the question with regard to how far apart are the parties, there is a paper, there are terms, but what is the intention, the goal of the respective parties? And Hamas has been, one has to just acknowledge this, cut through all the attempts to say, well, it can only ever be Hamas that's responsible for no deal. If you cut through all of that, there has been a consistent position that a deal can be made if this is an on-ramp to a permanent ceasefire, to Israel withdrawing from Gaza, Palestinians being able to go back to the areas where they previously lived, many destroyed, most destroyed, versus a position of the Israeli leadership, which says, we can have a pause, we can get some hostages back. By the way, there are very significantly less numbers of Israelis being held in Gaza still alive today than there were when these talks began. So the Israeli position is, we can do some of that, but the moment this first phase ends, we will continue with this relentless war on Gaza and all the human costs and catastrophes that have come with it. That's the Netanyahu position. So that then translates into a couple of things. One is, in the negotiating positions themselves, Netanyahu will put in all kinds of additional demands, which he knows will derail the talks. And then what do the mediating parties do? And here there is, of course, this isn't a team of equals when it comes to the mediators. There is a primus inter pares. That is the United States. That is the party who, as we just heard from Professor Makdisi, without the arms being sent to Israel, this could not continue. What does the U.S. do? Is it willing to, so to speak, lay the dead cat at the door of the party responsible, namely Prime Minister Netanyahu, or will it continue to run cover for Netanyahu? For months and months, it has been the latter. And now we see ourselves still in a regional conflagration dynamic. And I would finally just to note this. I think the talks planned for this week, there is a hope that maybe this theory that the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, is in recess. If you're going to get Israelis out, you're running out of time. There's perhaps a hope that maybe Netanyahu, despite everything, will go for a deal. But I think most of what this is about is trying to avoid the regional escalation by saying, hey, there are these talks, we can get that ceasefire. As we just heard, if you get a ceasefire in Gaza, you can de-escalate the region. So I think this is mostly an exercise in trying to create and sow some confusion and offer a ladder, perhaps, to Iran, Hezbollah, the axis of resistance, not to go there. And it's much less, sadly, about actually bringing an end to the horrific realities in Gaza. And I insist that let's just pause for a minute. What the people of Gaza are going through, the number of dead, the number of injured, the humanitarian conditions, the permanent displacement. You're sent from one place to another with no safety. This appalling word laundering of safe zones, which are no such thing, constantly attacked by Israel, schools, UN compounds. We hear from Palestinians and medical workers in Gaza that people have learned to identify what does a naval artillery sound like versus a drone versus a fighter aircraft about to drop, more often than not, American bombs on you. This is appalling, and it shouldn't. Let's be very clear. Israel being held to account for violations of international law and the insistence that Israel adhere to international law, an American or any other weapons not be used in the committing of crimes, war crimes, plausible genocide. This should not depend on ceasefire talks. This should end full stop because it is illegal.
And Daniel Levy, I wanted to ask you about the credibility of the United States before the world community, given the fact that President Biden more than 3 months ago said the outlines of a deal had already been agreed to by the parties. And here we are, and there still is no agreement.
I find it hard to put the words credibility in the international community and United States in one sentence after all of this. And I think much of the international community, if one can use that term, does so as well. What we are seeing right now is that Washington has only one playbook, and it is a failed playbook. It is a distorted playbook. And that consists of the following. Rather than restraining, reining in, pressuring, using the massive leverage you have on Israel so that Israel will desist from committing crimes, whether those are the mass crimes in Gaza or the extrajudicial provocative assassinations that threaten escalation. Rather than using your influence to prevent Israeli crimes, you try and use deterrence. You try and use threats to prevent Iran and others from responding to those Israeli crimes. Now, that does a few things. First of all, it means that by standing with Israel as it commits these crimes, you are complicit in the criminality in Gaza and in the continuation of that by enabling it. Secondly, I do think that there is something of an ideological alignment. And we just have to be clear, America is playing the role as a member of the axis of Zionist extremism. And I think the US wants Israel. Having seen the shift in the balance of power go against Israel, it wants Israel to reassert deterrence and to be able to drive escalation dominance. But then you ask the third question, and that's where I think you are going, Juan, which is to say, how does this serve America's interests? Surely there's a divergence of interest here. And I would say that there is. There is not an American interest in a regional conflagration, but because you're unwilling to restrain Israel, and all you are willing to do is to threaten the other side more, it means that you deploy more military assets. It means that you put America at the risk of being dragged into a war. That also means that your international reputation when you're running cover for an apartheid regime in violation of ICJ rulings with an ICC request for an arrest warrant against its leaders, it means that your reputation, as you suggest, is not only sullied, but it is being dragged through the mud on a daily basis. You can't claim to stand up for values, for international law, to be taking a principled position in Russia, Ukraine, or anywhere else when you are in this position of support for Israeli violations. And it also brings you to a place politically where if you're a Democrat administration, why are you letting this guy make the weather? There's a piece by the former head of the MI6, I'm here in London, John Sawers in the FT. And what he wrote just a few days ago was that he thinks Netanyahu wants to pull America into a regional war and wants to undermine the Kamala Harris candidacy and strengthen the prospects of Trump. And this is a trap that the Biden administration has made for itself. Let's be very clear. They are responsible for not drawing a line, for not reining Israel in, and for continuing to send the weapons. And it is not good enough. It is embarrassing and humiliating that what they occasionally do is they leak to Axios or some favored media out there, hey, Biden got really angry. He was really frustrated with Netanyahu on their phone call. Do me a favor, you're grown-ups. Be serious. You send the weapons. This is not America using its leverage. This is America basically lining up and trying to bring others in the region into alignment with an axis of Zionist extremism. And it will not deliver security for Israelis either, not in the short term and not in the long term.
Daniel Levy, we want to thank you for being with us. President of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Coming up, Washington escalates its efforts against Venezuelan President Maduro following July's contested election. We'll host a debate. Stay with us.
There's a new day coming. Everything gonna be turning over. Everything gonna be turning over. Where you gonna be standing when it comes? There's a new day coming, everything gonna be turning over, everything gonna be turning over, where you gonna be standing when it comes. For far too many years, I've been marching, singing, and talking, doing things I thought would make me free. While people halfway around the world, they've been fighting and dying and bleeding. Now it seems
there's a new world coming by Bernice Johnson Reagan. She died last month. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Venezuela, where the United States is reportedly escalating its efforts to remove President Nicolas Maduro following July's contested election, where both Maduro and his main rivals claim victory. Last week, Maduro, who was declared the winner by Venezuela's National Electoral Council, appealed to the Supreme Court to verify the results after opposition leaders Edmundo Gonzalez and Maria Corina Machado released thousands of vote tally sheets to back their claims of victory. Gonzalez failed to appear before the Venezuelan Supreme Court, saying he feared arrest, while the high court said Saturday the opposition has not yet submitted evidence to support its allegations. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro spoke from Caracas Friday.
Edmundo González Urrutia. Es escandaloso su ausencia ante el máximo tribunal del país.
The absence of Edmundo González Urrutia before the highest court of the country is scandalous, as was his absence on June 20th for the signing of the agreement to recognize the election before the CNE, National Election Council. He does not recognize the CNE as an institution. He does not recognize the Supreme Court. Who does he recognize? The government of the United States? So the statement of the three political parties who pushed this extreme right candidate is scandalous. They have nothing. They have nothing.
Dueling protests in support of Maduro and the opposition have taken place in Caracas and other parts of Venezuela. Over the weekend, Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, called for global mass protests August 17th. Meanwhile, the White House Monday denied reports by The Wall Street Journal that the Biden administration had offered Maduro amnesty in exchange for his resignation. This is White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre.
It's been 2 weeks after the elections in Venezuela. It is abundantly clear, right, to the majority of Venezuelan people, the United States, and growing number of countries, as you just listed, that Edmundo won the most votes in the July 28th election, presidential election, and Maduro must recognize it.
International rights groups have denounced reports of a violent crackdown against demonstrators. At least 25 people have died in protests since July 28th election. There have been some 2,000 reported arrests. Meanwhile, both Gonzalez and Machado have gone into hiding. For more, we're joined by two guests in Washington, D.C. Leonardo Flores is a Venezuelan political analyst, activist, founding member of the Venezuela Solidarity Network. And Alejandro Velasco is an associate professor at New York University, where he's a historian of modern Latin America. His new piece for The Nation is headlined, What's Next for the Left in Venezuela? Professor Velasco is former executive editor of NACLA Report on the Americas, joining us from Newport, Rhode Island. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start with you, Alejandro Velasco. Your assessment of what's taking place now in these Wall Street Journal reports of the United States offering amnesty for Maduro if he were to leave.
Yeah, it's a curious development. On the one hand, it's very hard to take it seriously or to assume that Maduro is taking it seriously. Of course, on the one hand, it's important for the United States, if indeed this happened, even if it's through back channels, to signal to Maduro and to the upper echelons of the Maduro government that it's willing to put significant stake on the table in order to execute a transition into a different type of government. On the other hand, what we've seen in both historically and recently is that claims of amnesty or offers of amnesty don't really have significant legal weight. We've seen this in Guatemala, we've seen this in Argentina, we've seen this in Chile, where, you know, negotiated transitions that rely on a potential amnesty for, you know, would-be human rights violators actually are reverted after the political conditions change. So, you know, my sense is that even if it is the case, it's not actually something that is seriously being considered in Caracas. On the other hand, what does seem to be the case is that you know, it does signal to by the United States that it is, like I said before, willing to, you know, put something on the table, and perhaps it's a gesture for the Maduro government to take the process or take the idea of negotiations towards a transition somewhat seriously.
And Alejandro Velasco, what do you make of the Supreme Court statement that the opposition has failed to produce evidence to the court of its allegations of election fraud?
I mean, the reality is that right now we're in a he said, she said scenario. Obviously, the opposition has released what it claims is a vast cache of electoral returns at the precinct level, which suggests a victory by Gonzalez by 2-1 margin. On the other hand, we have not received from the National Electoral Council, and this, we talked last week on this show, and the real question at the time was, you know, what will the National Electoral Council do relative to its obligations under Venezuelan law to release that data. And to the extent that it continues to not release the data for public scrutiny, what we have is, in Spanish, you say, dime se diretes, right? It kind of going back and forth. So, you know, I think that it is true to cast doubts on the claims of the opposition alone that it won by this margin because we can't actually verify it. But part of the reason why we can't do that is, in fact, a large part of the reason why we can't do that is because we don't have the data coming from the National Electoral Council. So, I think it's healthy to have significant skepticism of the claims by the opposition. Certainly, the statements by the U.S. White House spokesperson are, in some ways really difficult to accept at face value. That's why many countries in Latin America have said, well, we are not going to recognize Gonzalez as the winner. What we need is to push the National Electoral Council to do its job. So that's very much up in the air.
Put that same question to Leonardo Flores of the Venezuela Solidarity Network. The issue of at least three progressive governments the region, Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, have called on the Maduro administration and the election officials in Venezuela to produce actual vote counts and tallies, not just the total tallies, but also the precinct by precinct tallies. What's your sense of why that hasn't happened? And also the issue of whether the Venezuelan opposition, by posting stuff on or their returns on an internet site, is the same thing as producing evidence of valid counts to the court.
Well, thank you, Juan. Let me just first say that what we're seeing in Venezuela is a more sophisticated, more violent, and better planned version of Stop the Steal. The electoral authorities declared a winner, the loser in the election, without any credible evidence, is claiming fraud. They unleashed violence, and they threatened more violence. And I think that should really alarm progressives in the United States, because it's not only a similar playbook to what we saw here in 2020, but it's a similar playbook to what happened in Brazil when Lula beat Bolsonaro, and in 2019 in Bolivia, when there was false claims of fraud against Evo Morales that led to the coup in Bolivia. When we see the positions by Mexico, Brazil, and Colombia, I think what we're seeing really is them trying to take a middle position between the few countries in Latin America that have already declared Gonzalez to be the winner, like Argentina, like Peru, the other countries throughout the Americas that have already accepted the results by the CNE. And so they're playing this middle position in order to try to brunt the response by the United States. But we also see that the United States is already going back on its promises. President Biden, a few days after the election, he spoke with President Lula, and afterwards he tweeted that there was a pledge to coordinate any actions with these three countries of Mexico, Brazil, and Colombia. And those three countries haven't recognized the winner, but the United States already has. So I think that's very troubling, and we have to understand this, these claims of fraud, in the context not just of the ongoing economic war against Venezuela, which has seen sanctions kill at least 40,000 Venezuelans only in the first year alone, but in the context of a hybrid war against Venezuela, where we saw an attempted drone assassination attempt in 2018, a failed mercenary invasion in 2020, numerous failed calls for military insurrections, and calls from the opposition for foreign intervention. So we can't delink these attacks against Venezuela with these claims of fraud by the opposition.
Leonardo Flores, I want to ask this question of both Alejandro and you. You're both Venezuelan. The opposition to Maduro, where it falls, do you consider it, let's start with you, Leonardo, to be pro-U.S. Neocolonialist, all of it? Or do you see a lot of opposition within the left?
So, well, first of all, let's note that there were 10 candidates in these elections. 9 of them were in the opposition. The opposition is divided, and they always have been. And there's a spectrum. I wouldn't call any of those nine opposition candidates part of the left, but I would certainly call Edmundo González and María Corina Machado part of the far right, and their history shows that. In terms of the left in Venezuela, there is a so-called faction called what they call themselves dissident Chavistas, which is mostly made up of academics and former government ministers, but they don't have an electoral base. They have no power on the streets, and they really have little to no influence within Venezuela itself.
And let's put that question to Alejandro Velasco as well. Divisions in the left, those who support Maduro and those who don't.
I mean, on the one hand, the landscape that we just heard is certainly accurate. I think it's incomplete, though. We've seen whether we put the focus on sanctions, whether we put the focus on policies on the part of the Maduro government to specifically target popular sectors by way of, you know, security operations, etc. I think it is hard to claim that on the ground there is a significant amount of critique against the Maduro government from sectors that previously supported even Maduro, but certainly before Chavez. Some of these have left Venezuela in, you know, massive amounts of numbers over the last 10 years. I think the Chavismo internally and supporters abroad do themselves a disservice to, you know, by not recognizing massive amounts of discontent. We can talk and debate about the reasons for that discontent. Absolutely, the sanctions are part of that landscape. But to, you know, not move the needle and recognize that there is significant discontent on the ground at popular levels against the Maduro government is a recipe for basically placing all of what we understand to be the project of the Bolivarian Revolution that Hugo Chavez started and conflating it with Maduro staying in power. That is a tremendous risk that the left internationally runs if the left is going to try to have a continuing viable political project in Venezuela that's decoupled or delinked from Maduro in power.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to Leonardo Flores on this issue of the comparison you made to Trump and the 2020 Stop the Steal movement, allegedly. There's no doubt that the United States has systematically attempted for the last 25 years to remove the Bolivarian Revolution from power in Venezuela. But at the same time, it's not quite the same thing, because even the comparison to the 2020 election, because at least Trump was arguing against actual election results, state by state, city by city, and in his attempts to overturn that election, those election results. But here, there have been no published results of the election precinct by precinct. So it's not quite the same thing, is it?
It's not quite the same, but it is very similar. I mean, it's not just Trump, of course. It's also Bolsonaro. There are ties between Edmundo González, María Corina Machado, and the far right throughout the hemisphere. And yeah, you're right. We haven't seen the precinct by precinct results yet. The CNE has issued two bulletins showing the generalized results. By law, though, they have 30 days to present those results. We're not anywhere close to those 30 days being up, or about 2 weeks away. And already the CNE has turned over all of its data, including evidence of a massive cyber attack that occurred in Venezuela on July 28th, Election Day, and has continued since then, a cyber attack which we have evidence for from firms even in the United States, which have recognized the tenfold increase in denial of service attacks against Venezuelan websites, including the PSUV party.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank our two Venezuelan guests, Leonardo Flores, political analyst, activist, founding member of Venezuela Solidarity Network, and NYU Associate Professor Alejandro Velasco. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.